a podcast by three developmental psychologists, four developmental psychologists, and everyday folk with an interest in infant and child development. I'm Candy LaPan.
I'm Lana Luchkina.
And I am Dion Benton, and welcome back to yet another episode of the It's Innate podcast. Today, we have the great pleasure of having Dr. Franziska Ting on the podcast to talk about her really wonderful chapter on infant morality. But before we do that, I think it's only right that we introduce our new co-host, Dr. Elena Luchkina, who received her PhD in cognitive science from Brown University in 2019, where she worked with Dave Sobel, who actually turned out to be my postdoc advisor as well. He's a good guy. She is currently a postdoc at Northwestern University, where she works with Sandy Waxman. And she has quite a number of important publications in really important places. So she's published in Child Development. She's published in the Journal of Experimental Child Psychology, as well as in Developmental Science. And she investigates, among many other things, the development of symbolic communication with a specific emphasis on word learning. And her studies focus on the development of verbal reference, inferences about word meanings from social information, and the effects of multilingualism on adult semantics. We also have on the podcast our guest for today, Dr. Franziska Ting, who received her PhD in developmental psychology in 2020 from the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, where she worked with Renee Bayerjahn, who needs no introduction, and who is probably one of the first developmental psychologists to take Piaget on head-on, pertaining to her work on object permanence. Dr. Ting is a postdoc at Boston University, where she works with Deb Kellerman. And she too has quite a number of publications and impressive outlets. So she's published in the Proceedings of National Academy of Science, the Journal of Experimental Child Psychology, and the Journal of Neuroscience. And she investigates the early development of social moral reasoning. And she asks questions such as who do infants and children think have moral rights and responsibilities? What affects their perceptions of one's moral character and who they expect to deliver punishment following a transgression? How much punishment should be delivered? As well as what infants understand about moral obligation and other things. In her second line of research, she's actually looking at how infants and children detect animacy and what they know about the biological properties of animates, which we'll actually cover some of that today. So yeah, welcome. I hope that was a sufficient.
That was a very nice introduction. That was excellent.
Great, I'm glad it worked out.
This is like such a powerhouse episode of folks we're on with. I'm just so excited to chat with everybody.
I'm sort of intimidated. I have like all these bright minds and then you just have me. Yeah.
What are you talking about?
Yeah.
Definitely intimidated, but it's great though. So anyway.
We're excited. So I hope everybody, as Dion mentioned, picked up on this like very exciting news. I had to change my whole intro to intro our new co-host. So
if you only heard the beginning outtakes, this is only like the fourth sort of take.
We're very excited to have you.
Thank you. Thank you also for this really generous introduction. I am thrilled to be here.
Yay. Great.
It's going to be so fun. We're, as usual, going to dig in before we get to start and talk about Franziska's awesome work in moral development. We just like to start our show with a little bit of whatever's going on right now and some hot topic. And I feel like for most of us, that's getting back to the university. And that has been very different for different people, depending on where you are and what you're doing and what your university has decided to do. So yeah, we just wanted to take stock and see how people are feeling. What's the general vibe, first of all?
Yeah, so obviously I can only talk about my college. And so I am, as everyone knows me at least, knows I'm at Swarthmore. And so, our university, our college, has mandated that everyone be vaccinated, with the exception of folks with religious, exceptions, and certain health exemptions. At least as far as the last I checked, we're at about 94% fully vaccinated, and the expectation is that we'll reach something like 99% sometime in the next couple of weeks. It won't be 100%, of course, because you have people with exceptions. And so
is that among the students or also students and
this
faculty?
This is students, faculty, and staff. So with that, the expectation is that faculty teach in person. So we are all teaching in person. And it's really up to the professor as to whether or not they want to lecture with a mask on or off. So I tried doing it with a mask on, and it's just really difficult to project, especially when you're speaking in a lecture hall, which is one of the places I do lecture. So I lecture without a mask. But, you know, compared to this time last year, where or when I was lecturing on Zoom, like, I'm much happier now. There's just something about lecturing in person and being able to interact with students live that you don't get from, you know, Zoom.
What's your class size like, Dion? Do you have big classes or small?
Yeah, so, well, SWAT is a small liberal arts school. So for us, a big class size would be like 40. And that's really what I have in developmental psychology. But I'm also teaching research methods. And in that class, I'm teaching about 15 students, which is a decent sized class. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay.
So that's my perspective. I'm happy.
Feeling safer still going back to person. And I'm sure in those, in that context feels a lot better.
Well, I feel safer only because the university's college is requiring that people be vaccinated. I don't know if I would feel that way I say that for a particular reason. I don't know if I would feel that way if the college didn't have that mandate.
Yeah. Sure. That would be lovely. I'd love that if we could just import that policy over to my institution, I'd be feeling much better. No, we don't have that. We do have mask mandates, but, you know, small classroom with like 30 to 35 students, typically our classes, at least in my department, squish into a room together, wearing masks, but still, no, we don't have a vaccine mandate. I don't think that's gonna happen. And we don't really have, we've talked about this before, and we think it's like rather low, like our estimate for students that are vaccinated, higher for faculty and staff, estimated pretty low, like below 50%. But also part of that is very, the issue of like collecting data on who has those vaccines is really problematic because like, we don't have a system. It's like, they keep sending out, it's like a survey and they're like, fill this out and tell us if you're vaccinated. And I'm like, do you know anything about social science? Like nobody is going to fill that survey out. Like, so it might be better than that. We don't know. So it's definitely pretty sketchy at this point.
What about for you? Yeah. Either Francisco or Lena?
Yeah, I think at BU, it's similar to you, Dion, where there is a vaccine mandate and a mask mandate. But I'm not teaching as a postdoc. I don't have any like teaching assignments. So for me, it feels definitely safer because most of the time I'm just locked in my office, not really interacting with a lot of people. Everybody in our lab is vaccinated, which is really good. And I don't really have the statistics, but I would think because it's mandated, I would think that it's also going to be pretty high, just like in the 90% range, just like you. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I cannot imagine having to go back to campus and teaching in person if there's none of that mandate. For the listener, there is a very cute cat in Lana's
there is
background.
I know, I was trying to hold it back too, but that is such an adorable cat, Lana.
Thank you.
I love that cat.
This is Lily.
Hi, Lily. So I will say just quickly before I hand the mic over, so to speak, to Lena, that we're currently reporting 6 cases on campus. That's hard to believe for a couple of reasons. Well, one, I've seen lots of students like visibly sick, and I would imagine that a small subset of them have COVID. But more importantly, a lot of our students are involved in lots of different activities, right? And some of these activities require that the students be vaccinated. And also a lot of these activities sort of make explicit that if you are sick with COVID, do not show up. And so the problem is if you get tested on campus, you know, those organizations are going to be notified, right? And so I think in some cases, students are going off campus to get tested, you know, finding out whether or not they're positive or not and just not making it known. And so I guess similar to Candy, I think that the number is that, you know, even though our vaccination rates are great, I think the number might be an underestimate. Now, I have no data to back that up. But I would suspect just sort of intuitively that number to be a bit of an underestimate. I don't think that reflects reality. And moreover, our department has had 5 cases. So it's unlikely that all of the cases, with the exception of one, are coming from our department. We're not the only department on campus, right? So
yeah, I thought that as well, like just from my classes. So we get notified if somebody in our class is COVID positive. And so already I've had, I think probably like 6 or so students just in my classes. And when I look at the overall numbers, I'm like, there's no way that that many of those cases came just from my classes. I also wanted to say something to Francisca's point. I'm glad that you can like lock yourself away in your office. Have any of you seen that tool? I'm forgetting where it came from now, but they put it out where you can like basically put in the parameters of your job and workplace, and it tells you like your risk.
I saw this on Twitter.
Right. So like, it's
as I see everything.
Yeah. As like your point, Francisca, is like being in the classroom, there's basically no safe option, period. Like when you put in parameters, even if you're putting in like everybody has vaccines and they're wearing masks and like you're somewhat spaced out, it was pretty much like this is still a high risk situation. So I think we're
unless you're put in a classroom with big windows that you can open with very, very good air circulation, there's just nothing you can do.
And there's some social distancing and all this.
So Jinx. I'm at Northwestern, and I think so similar to Dion and Francisca, we have a vaccination requirement with a small exception of, you know, people like religious reasons or health conditions. I haven't checked the numbers recently. The last time I checked, the numbers were pretty high. I think they were also in the 80s or 90s. So we are returning to in-person instruction on campus. I think they're still doing a hybrid, so some of the classes are recorded, so the people who are particularly high risk can just watch them from home. I feel relatively safe. Everybody in my lab is vaccinated. And anytime anybody has been exposed, we get like free antigen tests for everybody. Mm-hmm. So we kind of keep track, and so we try to stay safe. I think personally, I'm less worried for myself than I am for spreading it, right? Because I'm young and relatively low risk, but I don't want to contribute to the spreading of the disease.
Yeah, of course. I'm sure for people too, like folks, if you have kids at home, that's like concerning, you know, that would be for me, like a big scary part.
That's true. Although I will add that I'm sort of a lucky parent in that my child is not school age, right? So there is no opportunity for her to interact with anyone that I don't put her in front of, right? Because she's not in school at all. You know, but I'm hearing friends who have school age children, you know, report that their kids are coming back with COVID, right? And so that's not something I'm dealing with, fortunately. But who knows what the situation will be like in 4 years when she is eligible for preschool, because then I'll have to deal with it, right? But for me, it's not really something that directly affects me, at least, because again, Alina is only 8 months old, right? So
little
baby.
Yeah.
I think that she needs to be on an episode of the podcast sometime, Dion.
Oh, she would love to be on the episode of the podcast. She will be the podcast, right? She's not much of a conversationalist yet, but just give her time. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, and it's also impacting, I mean, mentioning kids, right? We all do work with kids. So, yeah. I mean, there it's very different. So like, although we've come back as a university, like my research is... No, it has not gone back to in-person. I honestly haven't even tried because I don't feel safe like doing that. Even if it was allowed, I don't feel safe with that. Right. So I haven't tried to engage like in sending, you know, research assistants into the community again or bringing families on campus. But yeah, so we're still stuck doing online stuff.
What are you doing, Francisca? Like, how are you guys handling that?
Yeah, so for me, the projects that I'm involved in with DEP were actually testing children initially at the beginning of summer because we're at BU, and the vaccination rate in Boston is quite high compared to the rest of the country. So we felt quite safe at the beginning of summer to go to parks and start testing outdoors. The protocol is very, very short. We're all masked, we're all vaccinated, and we keep social distance too with the children. So we started doing that, but with the Delta variant rising, like I decided not to do that anymore just because of the number of the breakthrough cases. Children are still not vaccinated and children are more at risk. And then also when we were just starting to hear about the breakthrough cases, we went to a park. There are still parents with children there, but usually parents are quite willing to come to us and have their children participate. But in that particular visit, like we didn't have anyone, even though there were like parents and children. So we felt like maybe parents are starting to become uncomfortable again, having their child interact with a complete stranger, even though we have signs that we're vaccinated and all that. So for all those reasons, we're switching back to online protocols again. I know that when I was stuck, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Oh, no, go ahead. I didn't mean to cut you off. Go ahead.
Yeah, and I know that I still have a couple of projects with Renee that are not done yet from grad school. And I know that she was also thinking about having the lab reopen again this fall and have families come for a visit. But again, with the Delta variant, we just don't know. She has taken like extra precaution in the lab and also have like extra safety measures for the parents and all that. But I don't know. I'm not really sure how it's going to work out. I'm not sure if parents are going to feel comfortable bringing their babies to the lab. Like, I know that I'm not comfortable bringing my kid to the lab.
And with respect to like recruitment, how are you going about recruiting online participants?
Yeah. Oh gosh. So it's tricky because with Children Helping Science, one of the biggest problems, is that a lot of the children are actually faculty members' children. So a lot of these children are somehow like related to academic parents or somehow like it's a very academic community. And for that reason, I feel like our sample is definitely going to be biased and we just rely on that. So we are trying to have other outreach, other ways to like outreach to families. We are going to try like having like a Facebook ad, posting on various different social medias and word of mouth, really. So yeah, I think that's how we're recruiting. I know it's not ideal, but no, at the same time, like I don't know what would be quite cost effective.
Well, it's really good that you guys are being mindful about issues of external validity, right? Because I feel like that's something that's not talked about with respect to something like Children's Helping Science. I've thought about that too, but I haven't taken extra steps like your lab has to recruit elsewhere.
Yeah, but also I think it depends a lot on what you're studying. I feel like if you're studying infants, especially very young infants, maybe it's not going to matter as much. But given what we're trying to study in our project, so one project that I have with Deb is on children's understanding of the COVID vaccine. And you can easily imagine how the sample is going to be problematic if we only really rely on Children Helping Science. And the other one is also on children's perception of people with physical disability. And again, like you can really think of the many, many ways that being in a family with academic parents can bias that in one direction.
How about you, Lena? How are you guys going about recruiting?
Yeah, so I'm in an infant. Well, we're an infant and child development center. So, but my work is predominantly with infants, and I have switched to recruiting and testing on Lookit, right? This is the platform developed at MIT. It took us some time to get all the permissions ready, but we've been quite lucky. So I've been collecting quite a bit of data through there. And luckily for me, the quality of the data is quite high. So the only thing that we can't do is like automated eye tracking, which is a method that I typically rely on, but we're doing a manual eye tracking using like frame by frame coding, which is frequent in infant research for those who are, you know, aware. So yes, I would recommend, I've been quite happy, and Lookit sends out up to 50 emails per day to eligible participants. With that yield, I've been quite fortunate to test several dozen participants since maybe May.
I hope by 50 emails, you mean like 50 participants, like emails to 50 potential participants, not 50 emails to each participant.
Yes.
Yeah, let's make that distinction. Because I would be surprised if you have a high yield.
I'm going to stalk you emails until you purchase it.
50 times exactly. Right.
Correct. Yes. Oh, sorry about that. Yes.
No.
50 participants. Yes.
Right.
That was my assumption. Yeah. No.
Not spam people.
No. Yeah. Well, yeah, we're all doing what we can to make it work, I think. And
what about you, Candy? What are you doing?
We've been doing we put stuff on Children Helping Science and the other methods. We've created Facebook ads. We've done, we've also tried like locally advertising for the online studies. So like the same daycares and organizations that I would typically work with face to face, you know, having them in their newsletters or things like that, distribute information about the online study if parents are interested. Honestly, though, and this is partly because, so I come from a small teaching focused institution. So in terms of like money to do research, it's not really there. So it's usually me doing things on my own or with maybe like small internal grants. So my studies right now, we don't have funding for them. So there's no real incentive for folks, which is obviously problematic. But we did really well at first. So when the pandemic really first started, and I think that it was like new and exciting and everybody's like, oh, and they get their kid on Zoom and they're doing this video chat and whatever. And then very like as soon as the summer was over and so many kids were in Zoom school, I think it was just like the last thing that anybody wanted to do was to put their kids on Zoom again for some other thing, or parents were working on Zoom and then they didn't want to get off work and get on Zoom for something. Right. So we had just numbers completely nosedive after that. And we went weeks and weeks and weeks with no participants at all. So data collection has been very slow. And again, because of resources, we're also working on creating a look at study, whether or not that'll be effective or not. Currently without funding, we'll see. But I have a student that's almost finished programming one. And then we're also just trying to switch to do a little bit of adult research, you know, honestly, just because like, again, resources, it's hard. So, but it's interesting because it came out of our podcast episode. I haven't talked about this yet, but it was out of our episode with Meltem. I was really interested. Yeah, I got really interested in this disclaimer idea. Yeah. And so I wanted to know more. I think there was some stuff there that even with adults, we didn't seem to have enough information. So I have a student that I'm collaborating with, and she's going to do an adult study on disclaimers in particular contexts.
Cool.
Can you tell me, tell us a little bit more about what do you mean by disclaimer?
It's basically, a lot of Meltem. This is Meltem Usel, who's out of UVA. She's now doing a postdoc at Duke.
At Duke, right? Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. But basically, she does work on disclaimers that we give before we say things, or is one sort of context. But overarching, her work looks
like, I'm not racist, trigger but warning, and then I say something racist.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. And then
I don't mean to be rude, but this type of.
Okay. So it's not like, trigger warning that.
No. Okay. Although that's on my back burner, actually.
Yeah,
funny that you mentioned that, because that's another area that I've thought of. I was originally going to do an adult study focused on trigger warnings. Right. There's some interesting work out there. I forget his last name. It's Peyton. But there's some work there showing that like trigger warnings are perhaps not useful, or right. perhaps even counterintuitively provoke more anxiety. Mm-hmm. But I think there's some methodological issues there. This is more in the context. Meltem talks about it in the context of forgiveness, that like disclaimers could be used to prospectively ask for forgiveness before we say something rude. Right. So yeah, that's what we're digging into now. Very we'll see how it turns out.
That sounds really cool. And that's like, it's nice to know that our podcast is turning into a source of actual research ideas.
I mean, it is. It's really, I think that we've seen already that we've had a lot of cool stuff come out of this show. So I hope it
We have
going.
A paper under revision that was invited for a revision that was based on an episode that you and I are authoring. So, so yeah.
Wow,
yeah, absolutely.
That's amazing. That is absolutely amazing.
It's under revision, or it was invited for revision at CogDev. So,
yeah. Wow.
Well,
is
this that
morality paper?
We might be able to touch on it, or at least some of the ideas. But it's on the helping hindering stuff. Yeah.
It will be relevant, I think, for today. But
oh, yeah.
And the topic of morality. Yeah. So hopefully we're all settling in well, and we'll take like a little quick break here. And then when we come back, we'll get to dig into that topic of morality and talk a bit more about Francisca's work and this great paper.
The story is going to be a motherfucker when it come out.
So welcome back. In this segment, we are going to be able to talk with Francisca about her wonderful chapter titled Principles and Concepts in Early Moral Cognition. And so that I don't butcher what the chapter was about, I'm going to let Francisca talk about what the chapter was about, and we'll sort of go from there. So the floor is yours.
Okay. So in this chapter, basically me and my collaborators and co-authors, we want to cover kind of we want to summarize what's out there in terms of infant morality research. And we divided the chapter into two main parts. The first one, we talk about the moral principles and the findings about those moral principles that are present in infancy. So we talked about, for example, that there are four or maybe more moral principles, the first one being fairness. And I think there are a lot more findings regarding fairness. Basically, the in a nutshell, it's where we're thinking that infants, starting from the first year of life, they already have this expectations about fairness, and that, for example, when you're dividing resources among two similar individuals, that you should do so fairly. But also there are more and more findings out there suggesting that infants' idea about fairness is not just very simple. You have to, like, everybody has to have an equal number of things, or you have to treat everybody in exactly the same way, because they do take into account, for example, merit and previous possession and so on and so forth. And that's the same about the other three principles that we covered in this chapter. For example, harm avoidance. Infants do have an expectation that you should limit the amount of harm that you commit to other people. In-group support, that you should care for your in-group. You should be loyal to your in-group. Basically, like infants expect individuals to have a preference for their in-group member as opposed to non-in-group members, and also for authority, for people to obey an authority figure, or for a person who's more dominant to prevail over another who's less dominant. So those are the four moral principles that we covered. These are, by no means, we're not saying that these are the only four moral principles that infants have. It's just that given the empirical studies that has been done, it seems like these are the four principles that we're seeing in infants. And the idea about these four principles, we don't come up with them on our own. We base it on a lot of the adult work. So, for example, like Jesse Graham and also Tesh Rai and Alan Fisk and Jonathan Haidt and some other people. So yeah, so those are the four principles. And then we moved on to talk about moral concepts. So other than the principles that infants have and these principles that guide the expectations about how individuals should treat one another, they also seem to have expectations about certain moral concepts. So we also covered four moral concepts, the first one being moral obligations. And then we talked about moral status, moral circle, and moral character. There aren't as many findings about these four concepts. And again, we're not saying that these are the only four concepts that infants might have expectations about, but we're starting with these four. And I can talk about, for example, like moral status. So We know based on published studies that infants, for example, have expectations about fairness, but who do infants actually endow with moral rights? As adults, we know that, you know, moral rights, like people have moral rights. Some people might argue that animals have to maybe to the same degree as people or to a lesser degree than people, some moral rights. But probably you wouldn't ascribe moral rights to pencils, right?
Why wouldn't you?
Yeah. So what about infants? Like, who do infants actually think need to be treated fairly? Who do infants think should be, you know, should not be harmed, for example? And there's not a lot of data on this. Some of the work in fairness in infants do have control conditions that show that infants actually expect fairness when you're distributing resources to puppets, for example, or animate geometric figures that are animated, or to people. However, when you replace the recipients of these objects with inanimate objects, for example, like a baby bottle or pillows, infants no longer expect fairness. They don't care whether you distribute the objects fairly or unfairly to these recipients, or inanimate puppets. So even though the outward physical appearance is exactly the same, if the puppet never moves, so it's just like a stuffed animal, right? The puppets,
right.
Infants actually no longer expect us to, or humans at least, to treat these inanimate puppets fairly. But what cues exactly do infants use to ascribe these moral rights? How do they know that if the puppets are moving and talking, for example, that they need to be treated fairly, or at least they think that way? Whereas pillows don't need to be treated fairly. So we, Renee and I came up with this idea where we would present infants with two novel boxes. They're just boxes. We cover them with colorful fabrics. And then we show the infants certain animacy cues. So what if these boxes are only self-propelled? So they can move on their own, but they don't show any other animacy cues other than those self-propulsion. Or what if the boxes were shown to be agentive, so they can detect their environment, they can respond to their environment in a contingent way. And the way we establish this is for the boxes to have a conversation with each other or with an experimenter, which is a commonly used method in infant research to establish agency.
Quick question. What does a conversation between two boxes look like?
Yeah, so the boxes, I know. So the boxes would just make beeping noises. So they would beep, one would start beeping.
It would
beeping,
be contingent beeping, I'm guessing.
It would be contingent beeping, and yeah. The beeping were variable. So imagine like two R2-D2s. that's the best way that I can explain it without showing you the video.
I think that's a very, very good R2-D2s. Description.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Well, for me, it was either they did that or they like were treating them like puppets. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. If you could but see Katie would... right now, she's miming puppeting.
Yeah. Yeah. But these two boxes in that particular condition where it's only agentive but not self-propelled, they wouldn't move at all. So they would just make the beeping noises. And then we also had a condition where the boxes were both self-propelled and agentive, basically.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
So what we're finding, we're not done with data collection, but we're almost done. What we're finding currently is that infants do not expect fairness to apply when the two recipients are just boxes that are only self-propelled or only agentive, but they do expect these boxes to be treated fairly when they're both self-propelled and agentive.
Both cues are jointly necessary, but neither sufficient. Gotcha.
Right. And there are a couple of ways to interpret this finding. One way to interpret this finding is that infants have a separate category for animate entities that are distinct from entities that are only self-propelled or entities that are only agentive. And we have some support for this idea based on like Pepe Seto's work, for example. I don't know how familiar you are with that, but Pepe Seto and Renee and Diwu and I believe Rochelle Gelman is also an author on this paper. They had a paper published in 2013 or 2014 showing that infants do expect novel entities that are animate to have insights, but not necessarily entities that are only self-propelled or only agentive.
Kaminsky also has some of this work, remember?
Right. Which is more recent. So where's my line of thought? But basically, based on that, it seems like it could be that, or it could just be two, as long as you know, these boxes have more than one Q. So maybe like two Qs of self-propulsion or two Qs of agency, not necessarily that it has to be like self-propulsion agency, if sure. You know what I mean. Yeah, so there could be those two possibilities, and we haven't run the conditions where if we show like two Qs of self-propulsion, would it work, or two Qs of agency, would it work?
Idea is that it's possible that the reason the jointly necessary and sufficient cues might have worked,
right,
not necessarily because you have two separate cues to agency,
two separate, like, right,
but it's just that you have two things,
right? Yeah,
yeah, exactly.
So it could just be that. But the reason why we're not thinking that that might be the case is because in these conditions, we try to equate the what the boxes did across the condition. So for example, in the agentive condition, but not self-propelled, the boxes were, what we're showing is that one of the way that we established this is that we had the boxes we had two familiarization condition. In the first familiarization condition, one of the boxes would just like move and make noises, but the other box would not contingently answer to it. So in a sense, like what each box did is exactly the same as the one in the animate condition where the boxes were self-propelled and agentive, but it's not that the beeping is no longer contingent because, oh, I'm sorry, I didn't explain this very well. In the self-propelled condition, I mentioned it wrong. In the self-propelled condition, so the boxes would move forward, they would still make the same kind of beeping noises, but it's no longer contingent because in the first familiarization trial, one box would do that. Second familiarization trial, the second box would do that, but they would no longer answer each other. I don't know, was that clear enough? Okay. Yeah. So in a sense, like each box would still show the exact same capability. So those are two cues, but the beeping noise is no longer serving as a cue for agency. Mm-hmm. And in that case, it no longer works. We also piloted like another condition where the boxes were shown to have fur, which is kind of a morphological feature. Like a morphological similarity to familiar animals, for example. And also if they're shown to have fur and they can interact with each other contingently, infants do seem to expect them to be treated fairly. But again, if you have fur and you can respond contingently to each other, it seems that infants also treat them as animates, at least based on Pepe-Seto's work. So again, our thinking about this is that infants might think that, you know, animates are a separate entity categories, they're distinct from entities that are only agentive or only self-propelled, and they do seem to attach another whole different set of expectations about animates that they may not necessarily have about entities that are lesser than animates.
Mm-hmm. And this ties back, though, Francisca, to your point that if they then could identify some entity as an animate, then they would ascribe some type
right.
of moral status to them, where we would right. expect that we treat them fairly and have some
yeah.
other expectations maybe about morality.
Right. And what we're really curious about, but I just haven't had a chance to like start these projects because of COVID. what we're really curious about is really like, would each of these moral principles apply differently or not? So for example, like these boxes, even though infants expect them to be treated fairly, do infants actually expect them to also not be harmed by a human experimenter, for example? Mm-hmm. And if we're talking about moral rights, then what about moral responsibilities? Do infants actually think that these boxes need to treat like other people or other boxes fairly or whatever it is? But at least we're starting to uncover the cues that infants use to, like these bottom-up cues that infants use to establish who they think have moral rights, at least when it pertains to fairness.
Sure. Yeah.
This is fascinating, Francisca. And I just wanted to, you know, ask how young were the infants you tested? And just sort of to follow up on that question also, mm-hmm. Do you think that at least in your chapter, you describe the principle of fairness as the sort of broadest, mm-hmm. applying to the broadest audiences principle, right?
Yeah.
And so here you are even showing that, you know, something that shows some cues to agency mm-hmm. and animacy would be ascribed those properties. Do you think that those principles might be present from the beginning? Is it something that human beings are born with? Is it something that maybe babies pick up on during development? Just can you elaborate a little bit on those questions?
Yeah, so the infants that we're testing in my particular project is, I think the average is 14 month olds, I believe. So they are slightly older. They're in their second year of life. And I really want to say that it's present from life just to annoy Dion.
Say it.
But to be honest, I don't think we have enough data to be able to say whether it's present from birth or not. With fairness on its own, without these boxes, when we're using puppets, the earliest results that we got from Renee's lab is, and the lead researcher on this is Melody Bugazar Dawkins. She found fairness expectations starting from 4 month olds, I believe. The age range, I think, starts from like maybe around like 3.5 to like 5.5. And she found that infants at that age have some expectations about fairness, and also with 9 month olds. So it seems that expectations about fairness, at least it's already present from like 3-4 month olds. But it's also really important that she's finding these results when the amount of resources that they're distributing, the toys that they're distributing, is using two objects. In Jessica Somerville's lab, they didn't find that infants expect fairness until 12 months and above. And that's because in their lab, they use 4. And so in our lab, when we do fair, unfair, it's either 1-1 or 2-0. Mm-hmm. In Jessica Somerville's lab, she did either 2-2 or 3-1. And one possibility is, of course, that infants at the very beginning of life, when they think about fairness, they think about it as kind of like very, like, I don't really want to say like all or nothing, but they think about it very simply, that as long as someone gets something, it's fair. They don't necessarily take into account that, oh, your share is larger than his share or whatever it is.
Reasoning about like about proportions versus right. like one person got some and you got none. That's right, kind of right. easier to, you know, right. visually see right. and understand than like the ratio of yeah, how much yeah, each right. got. Yeah. yeah, for sure.
And it could be probably some interactions with like numeric cognition, and right?
Mm. Right, absolutely. And Nadia Cherniak actually has some work looking at early expectations about fairness and how that's related to numerical cognition. But yeah, that's what we're thinking. And would it work if, let's say, the ratio, just like what Candy mentioned, if the ratio, we make it so big, for example, like one person receives like one item, the other one receives 100 items, would infants at 3 months old notice that or not? Like, these are open empirical questions that I think would be very exciting to explore, but at least that's what we know.
So yeah, I'd like to ask a slightly different question.
Yeah.
And I want to sort of take a step back and talk about these principles in sort of as a broad sort of set of ideas that babies are supposed to have. And the question I have, I want to sort of start off by saying that I don't actually dispute that we as humans have access to principles like these. Mm-hmm. You know, my actions are governed by, and I'm also sensitive to, moral principles. Right. Mm-hmm. There are certain things I do and certain things I don't do. What's sort of unclear to me is, and you seem to have acknowledged that, you know, there's just not enough data to know whether or not these principles are there from the beginning. They could be, but we just don't know.
Yeah.
Right. And so what we're left having to do then is to sort of speculate. Right. And so, which is fine. And so the question I guess I would have is, if we sort of agree, just for the sake of argument, that these principles maybe aren't there from the beginning, what, you know, by what developmental process would these principles emerge?
Yeah.
But also, you know, if, for example, we stipulate that, oh, no, these principles are in fact there from the very outset, well, what evolutionary mm-hmm. explanation would sort of explain the emergence of these principles and not other ones, right? Because you stipulate 4 specific kinds of principles.
But she also clarified that there may be other principles that yeah. she didn't discuss. These are just ones that have come out of research that people have
yeah. And that's fair, but right. we still are left with the question of how do those principles, or any principles, right, it could be other principles, yeah. how do these principles come about? What is the process, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I think those are really good questions. And yeah, I don't know. I think the question of whether something is innate or not, it's really, really hard. Because, you know, unless you can test it once a baby is born, and then you can immediately test them. Oh, do you actually like understand fairness? Is it present from like birth or not? Like it's just difficult.
That combined with the fact that they learn prenatally, right? There's a lot of
prenatally. right. Like the mother just like rubs the belly and say like, you have to be fair.
Okay. Well, maybe not for this particular, you know, domain,
but I know exactly what you mean. But I don't know. Right. And as you said, like it's hard to know like what is innate, what is not. I think again, like between people who are nativist and empiricist, even though like the line is not that black and white, but between, just to make it simpler, like between nativist and empiricist, like we always like shift the ball back and forth, right? Who has the burden of proof? Like who has to prove whether something is present from birth or whether something is learned? And I don't know. I don't know whether.
Well, let's consider distribution. Let's consider distribution. So like distribution of resources, right? Why couldn't it be the case that, you know, one way in which the child learns to distribute things fairly among in-group members is they're simply told. So like there's an instance where I try to distribute things unfairly and mother tells me, no, that's not fair. You know, you want to give your brother two cookies and you have two cookies. Well, that seems like a simple enough way in which babies can learn about something like, you know, equal distribution. Right. And there doesn't seem to be any compelling reason to argue that it could be. Right.
Yeah.
But the fact that there is this other process going on could sort of equally explain something like the emergence of distribution. Right. And that seems like a simple enough mechanism, a simple enough explanation for the emergence
of
that principle.
But then you can also like ask back, right? Like, is that actually that kind of teaching? Is that actually enough? Because there are a lot of cognitive heuristics, maybe, if that's the right way to think about it, like cognitive intuitions or cognitive heuristics that people have worked their entire life to kind of like
unlearn,
but it's really hard. So I don't know whether if that's how you think about it. So imagine if like a mom say, this would be a very bad mom, but if a mom say that whenever you're distributing resources, you have to be unfair, like would that child actually immediately like pick that up? And every time, like now their expectation is completely the opposite.
I get what you're getting at.
Right. Well, so if you're saying that there is a learning mechanism, and I'm not saying that learning doesn't happen, it does happen. And across cultures, we do see variations about what people think is fair in a particular situation is unfair in another situation. We do see that variation, but at the same time, like how do they exactly learn and how do they maybe interact with anything that is air quote innate? So
I'm not going to dominate the conversation, but I'll just sort of quickly respond with my own rejoinder. You're right. It's a difficult question. It's not an easy question. And what you just argued is exactly the kind of test that would start to begin to answer the question of whether or not these principles are at least early emerging, irrespective of whether they're innate.
Dan's going to bring your babies into the lab and tell them to be unfair.
Your idea is it's a very good idea. And the idea is that, well, if they have these principles, right, and let's assume that these principles are innate, whatever that means, then it should be difficult to teach them, moral events that are at odds with what you and I know to be the case, right? In fact, these principles are early emerging. Now, it seems like you're sort of, you know, unsure whether or not this is an innate thing or not. But I guess the question I would have, the next question is, okay, let's assume that it is innate. Okay, that's fine. Well, what would be the evolutionary process? What would be the evolutionary process that would give
you rise to those? You did it, Francisca. You did it. You converted him.
Yes, innate.
It's recorded. Yeah. We have proof. Dion said it.
Yeah.
If we were to stipulate that.
By the way, if anyone is on the.
I just thought that what he's saying is quite interesting. I just wanted to make like build up on that line of reasoning a little more. Because Francisca, you did say that, you know, we can look cross-culturally because, you know, the teaching methods and the even like more nuanced moral principles vary a little, right, from culture to culture.
Yeah.
So that could give us a bit of a window of opportunity
to
infer things. But also, I wonder if
are cultural norms that different?
I think it it depends on the question. Like cultural norms are can vary quite a bit on like what's considered, mm-hmm. for example, like altruistic, what's considered egoistic, right?
Yeah.
At least those. But I also wonder, Francisca,
okay, how do you measure that?
Let her finish, Dion.
That's a really good question. But okay. I wonder if you're familiar with any non-human research on non-human participants, like maybe non-human primates, maybe on like mm-hmm. other mammals. Is there any analogy in the animal world to the principles that you're talking about in this chapter?
Yeah, as far as I'm concerned, there has been a very limited number of findings out there. I know that with chimpanzees, don't quote me on this, but with primates, I can't remember exactly which kind. The paradigm is slightly different, of course. Like they weren't measuring looking times, but they showed, you know, primates that were given cucumbers, which is a low value reward, and so usually when there's no comparison, if they were given cucumbers, they would take it. But if they were given like a high value resource, I think it was grapes or something. But if their friend, the primate friend, is given grapes, but they're only given cucumbers, then they would reject it. But if there's no comparison and they're given grapes, they would take it. Given cucumbers, they would take it. Mm-hmm. But I know that there's also debate about how exactly to interpret this data. Is this actual like fairness expectations in chimpanzee, expectation to be treated fairly at least? Or is it something else? Is it social comparison? What is it exactly? So I think, but that's always going to be the case with social cognition. It's always going to be complicated and there are so many variables. But the short answer is like, I don't think there has been any studies with like a lot of studies with non-human animals that has the same paradigm as how we're studying infants.
Would you think that one of the reasons then, Francisca, this is not a question that I prepared ahead of time. This just came up now. So
yeah.
brush me off if it's
no problem. No problem at all.
But do you view that then as like something that is like
uniquely human?
Yeah, like uniquely human, that part of this like expectation of fairness is like mm-hmm. something special about human social cognition that maybe is not there and we can't really study that well in other species because it probably doesn't exist.
No, I wouldn't. I don't have strong intuitions one way or another. I don't know. I think it'd be a very exciting task to do. That's definitely outside of my area of expertise. I wouldn't even know where to begin if I were to study it with.
Didn't mean to put you on the spot.
right. But what's interesting, I think I read this finding. I can't remember if it's published now or not, but Doc at least, right? Like when they were shown like a helper or hinderer, like they do have a preference for a person who has been prosocial or helpful as opposed to a person who has been antisocial or unhelpful. So at least it seems that they do have that kind of like expectation, maybe, if you would want to call it. But at the same time, like dogs have so much interaction with humans. And I don't know whether that would be true in other animals,
sure.
or whether sure. there are methodological problems or not. Like I wouldn't mm-hmm. know. I wouldn't even know like how to.
I definitely don't think that my dogs want anything to be fair. I think that they want all the biscuits for themselves.
Yes.
My one dog goes and steals all the toys mm-hmm. from everybody else and takes them for himself. Mm-hmm. Maybe preferring pro-social people, though. Who knows?
Yeah. And Dion, to answer your question about the evolutionary process that would give rise to this, I think it's hard to say about each of the principles, but I think there has been a lot of work out there looking at the evolutionary process and how it might actually explain why humans have morality or at least some moral principles in the first place, whether that be just fairness, whether that just be like harm avoidance, or whether it's a combination of all of these like harm and fairness and maybe like some other principles.
There's clear selection pressures to being able to distinguish between pro-social and anti-social. One, for example, right. is failing to do so could actually lead to your death, right? Failing to, you know, distinguish between people who have my best interests at heart and those who don't could literally mean that you're not going to survive long enough to reproduce. And so, you know, there are some compelling, I think, evolutionary explanations. I guess my pushback is just that the world is just so regular in its statistics that couldn't these things just be learned? You know, why you know, assume that, you know, that these evolutionary pressures have given rise to these core systems, whatever you want to call them, innate principles or what have you.
Right? Yeah. At the same time, though, there are so many things that has been carried through throughout like human evolutionary processes that are present, right, in our cognitive makeup, whatever it is. Yeah, so I don't know whether morality would be part of that. I'm not saying that it cannot be learned. I think it can. But at the same time, I think, again, like, where is the burden of proof? Like, if we're saying that, for example, infants at 4 months, like, they have these expectations of fairness by 4 months, like, within, if we discount, like, all prenatal learning, how are you teaching 4 months to know how a person should distribute resources, and how many instances would they have seen, for example, like their mother dividing resources between two other people, the same kind of resources among two different people, and so on and so forth. And of course, when we're looking at older infants, there are going to be more and more learning experiences that they have received. But I think that's why I think a lot of infant researchers try to go younger and younger and younger. I think precisely to try to give more support for this kind of question one way or another.
I mean, and let's be honest, I'm going to acknowledge this, you know, there are certain limitations for testing too young of infants. Why? Because they have limited, you know, different limited capacities.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. And so the absence of, or, you know, failing to show evidence of morality.
Right.
At 1 month doesn't necessarily mean that.
Yeah, it could just be a methodological problem.
Right. So I acknowledge that, you know, but still 4 months is that's 36 months of a lot of experience and not just sitting there, you know, like, lumps on a log. They're being carried around. They're being talked to. Right. They're being interacted with. They're seeing a lot of things. Their vision is improving. Right. And so they're receiving a lot of input. And the input isn't a blooming, buzzing confusion, as William James might have it. The input is quite consistent and quite regular, right? And we have, as I'm sure everyone here would acknowledge, that we have, you know, mechanisms like statistical learning and association and all these other mechanisms that are there, right? And that are present in non-human mammals as well, right? And so that's my, you know, that's sort of my general take on these things.
Yeah, and you could be right. But again, I think I'm not trying to say that all the burden of proof is on you, but at the same time, like, I would be really interested in knowing what you think about the learning mechanism. Well, not you as a person, but what people who say that, you know, at 4 months old, like, infants learn expectations about fairness and distribution of resources. Like, what exactly are the input? What exactly are the learning mechanism?
Well, Kenya and I actually have a paper you know, that was invited for a revision where we try to take this issue head on with respect to helping and hindering and pro-sociality.
Yeah, yeah.
And there we actually do articulate a mechanism, and it sort of rests fundamentally on the idea that what's happening in those studies is not so one interpretation, which is the common interpretation, is that the reason the babies choose the helper is because they prefer it. There's a social preference, perhaps based on some moral core, right? But I actually don't even think, and Kenny and I have talked about this, we don't actually think that we don't dispute the choice. That is what they're choosing. It's reliable, but we dispute the interpretation of the choice. And I think actually what probably is happening is they're sort of expecting some kind of interaction from the helper in a way that they don't expect from the hinderer. And there's an actual account that could sort of explain why or how they come to prefer, or that is how they come to choose the helper, right? And importantly, the account, doesn't presuppose a social preference. There's nothing social going on, at least on our account, right? So you say, you need a mechanism, a mechanistic account. Well, we have mechanistic accounts for how some of these things come on that don't assume that what we're seeing is a social preference or anything like that.
Sure. I mean, I think that I will always like make sure to clarify that like this isn't like, oh, there's some great method out there that like all of these very intelligent, highly qualified researchers are just not using to like answer this question. It's just that there's certain things that don't exist yet. And then on either side, whether it's talking about learning, like we can do these computational models and we could, you know, presuppose ways that infants might be learning in a really quick way and a way that doesn't necessitate that they're actually making moral or social judgments. But like, there's also not great methods out there to make a determinative answer on whether or not this is something that is more or they're coming to the table with or they're learning. So I think that we don't, you know, just to clarify, like we're not saying that anybody's not also doing something they should be.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Because in the end, right, we are trying to make an inference about what some little nonverbal creature is thinking and what their conceptual interpretation of something is that we're showing them. And in the end, we're always having to make some type of assumption of how they're interpreting those events. Yeah. And we try to include all the necessary controls and comparisons, but we still always have to make an assumption in the end because we're just, that's, we're limited in the methodology that we
and
have.
And to sort of quickly piggyback on that, we also acknowledge at the end of the paper that, you know, we're arguing, we do argue an account, but it's sort of a sufficiency account, right? Just because we are showing that this could happen this way doesn't actually mean that that's what's happening.
Right.
But the very fact that we can show it means that, you know, you sort of want to really think carefully about what is the process going on. You know, what is the underlying mechanism? So
I love that. Every time I talk to Dion, it's always like, but what is the underlying mechanism? And I love that pushback, to be honest, because I think
I'm like a perseverator on mechanism.
Let it go. Yeah. No, he doesn't. It's okay. Yeah.
So for example, like so I'm not too familiar with your paper. It's been on my reading list for a while, but I just haven't had the chance to get around to it.
Reading.
So you can probably talk about it a little more, but you mentioned about, you know, maybe they just expect some kind of interaction from the pro-social helper, but not from the antisocial individual. And I'm just curious, can you just talk, either Candy or Dion, like, can you talk a little bit more about that and what you mean exactly by that? Because that's also interesting.
Yeah, so the idea quickly is that they literally are expecting to be interacted with by the helper. Now, this, of course, raises the question, well, how does this expectation come to be? That is, what's the process?
Yeah.
Well, one account, the account we try to argue and then we sort of instantiate in a model is that, well, as the baby is going about their everyday lives, they're encountering people or agents that engage in one of two kinds of action. Of course, it's not exclusive that, you know, an individual agent can engage in multiple kinds of action. But the world consists of agents that engage in what we call concordant action, so consistent action, so two people moving around space together, right? And then you have agents that engage in discordant action, which is sort of like actions that's antagonistic. So like me, like us getting into a physical altercation would be sort of an instance of discordant action. Well, what they then learn in other instances is that those agents that tend to engage in concordant action tend to stick around long enough to interact with socially other agents, right? Whereas those agents that engage in discordant action, so antagonistic action, for one reason or another, don't tend to stick around. I mean, imagine a fight. Two people who fight aren't going to stick around and hang out together. They're going to sort of leave, right? And so the idea is that as the baby is encountering these instances, they're learning these sort of associations. So they're learning, for example, that, okay, those agents that engage in concordant action tend to have this capacity for interaction. Now, they have no specific expectations about what kind of interaction, because interaction different, like the different, an infant can see different kinds of interaction. But importantly, they learn these associations such that then when they get to the lab, get to the lab and they see an agent that engages in concordant action, this triggers the expectation that, oh, this thing has the capacity for interaction, because in the real world, those things that tend to engage in, that tend to move concordantly, tend to subsequently interact with other people. And it's on this basis that they choose the helper. Notice that this has nothing to do with sort of a social preference. This is just based on these them learning these associations.
No moral inference is like
no moral inference, right?
Specifically the key. Like they might even be learning something. I mean, that is like something about social interaction, right? Like what, how mm-hmm. other agents may interact with me, but it doesn't necessitate saying that like an evaluation that this person is good and this person is bad, or even that I have like some moral preference for somebody. I think it's more about the labels that we give for that they are interpreting a display as one person being a helper and one person is a hinderer, and we have a positive evaluation of helpers and a negative evaluation of hinderers. So it's, I don't think that it's like so discordant to say that like it's not related to some social learning and learning about mm-hmm. social relationships, but that they perhaps are learning something different than what folks have said.
We also,
Sorry. So would it be wrong for me to understand it as like, you're not necessarily thinking that infants don't interpret the helping or hindering action as not necessarily helping or hindering? So it's not the problem with the interpretation of the events. It's just that the reaching, what does that mean exactly? Or are you thinking that infants may not necessarily even think about the helping and hindering action as positive or negative action? Because when you say Dion, for example, like concordant is discordant action, like what exactly do you mean by this? Is it there, is there still like a positive or negative evaluation about these actions? And if not, if you don't necessarily think these, that infants just interpret these events as two different kind of events, like how are you exactly thinking about that in relation to like the Premack findings, for example?
David Premack. So this is a really good question, actually. And this is a question that I was asked when I gave this talk a while ago at UPenn or something. And the question was specifically, well, like, how are you interpreting concordant and discordant action?
Right.
Right. The way you describe it seems like they're valence in some way, like it's positive and negative valence. And my response was simply that, these kinds of actions, infants are analyzing simply at the low level, at the lowest level. They're just, they're sort of perceptual spatial movements that these bodies are engaging in. Right. Mm-hmm. And it just so happens to be the case that this kind of spatial movement, in irrespective of the valence, the sort of positive or negative valence of it, tends to be correlated with different kinds of action and interaction. And it's on this basis. Right now, it's possible, and I certainly agree that at some point those actions do take on some valence, because I said because by and large, discordant action tends to be antagonistic. There are exceptions, of course. But by and large, that kind of action tends to be, I would argue, again, negative. And infants do learn that. They have these mechanisms in place. But at least for that early work, I don't actually think they see these actions as negative or positive. It's just that these actions tend to be associated with different kinds of outcomes.
And also that discordant actions, I don't think, are ones that they encounter as often.
Right.
So like, I mean, to even generate examples of where we see things, and this is completely speculation, right? Because we obviously don't have any type of like, you know, head mounted camera data on like what type of actions concordant or discordant babies are tending to view. But in trying to generate examples of those things, it's very hard to think about times in which people are acting in discordant ways, unless perhaps we're thinking about very specific examples of like, maybe babies that come from homes where people fight quite a lot or something, but most of the time we're moving together, you know, we're moving in the same direction, you know, moms and dads are pushing strollers, we're walking
together.
When I
lift up a lid, you're not going to like jump on the lid and slam it shut. Like we work together.
Right? We lift things up together. Yeah. And so again, in some cases.
I know, and they have siblings.
But it's not the mere presence of an exception. It's the accumulation of, it's the weight of the evidence. Yeah. And so they may see exceptions, but by and large, the evidence points in the other direction. That's the idea.
Yeah.
Interject here, because I think I hear a parallel between what Candy and Dion you were saying, and then Francisco you're showing in one of your experiments. So Candy and Dion, you're arguing that basically those who tend to cooperate or engage in concordant action, generally more, it sort of, that property correlates with being more capable of social interactions, which is potentially intrinsically rewarding, something that infants want, mm-hmm. right? And I recall that Francisco was describing the attribution of the moral status to entities that interact in a socially contingent manner. So I wonder if those are the similarities between the arguments, because interacting in a socially contingent manner basically does mean interacting in a sort of concordant way. It's cooperative, right? We're not like turning away from each other to produce social contingent actions. At least this is actually one of the manipulations in studies that do manipulate the level of social contingency and what it entails. So it does seem to me that entities that interact with each other in a socially, in a concordant way, right, produce concordant actions, are attributed moral status. And potentially, according to the argument made by Candy and Dion, they are preferred because they're more capable of social interactions or sustained.
They just choose them. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But is there any, I guess I never really thought about it in this way, but is there any other research, and Dion, maybe you already talked about this and I've forgotten it, but like anything just looking at, I mean, infants' preference for trying to interact with like objects versus objects that have some of those animacy properties, and like maybe one of them is getting at this. So it's
Rebecca
not exactly.
Sachs has some work. It's not moral work, but she definitely has work showing that these animacy cues are important for learning things like which kinds of agents are capable of ballistic motion, for example.
Right. So like, you know, I mean, I sort of think about it in that same vein as like, while we have all these animacy cues, maybe there's something else that infants are learning that is a cue for potential interaction. And that, you know, it's just, for me, the key is that it doesn't hold a moral judgment. Exactly. It's like there's no moral weight behind this decision. And I think that that's more something that perhaps we're inferring based on more of how we as adults interpret those displays that we show to infants. That's often what I think might be part of it.
Although I'm sure Francisco would
say, though, actually, no, what I would say actually, and Dion and Candy, is that I think you are right in saying that with this, when you're saying that there is no moral evaluation with the preference task, I think you could be right. I don't know whether you're right or not. And again, it's speculative. I think you could be right. It could be that, right. No, yeah, definitely. It could just be that those are non-moral evaluations. Which is why I think in my intro, like we started by saying that initially the findings with infants, it shows that infants seem to be able to at least differentiate these kinds of actions, the positive and negative actions. Whether they attach a moral value to it, we don't know based on these social preference tasks, whether they pick the helper or the hinderer. And the way we think of it is, but then after that, the way we think about it is probably slightly different from you, in that we're looking at expectations. So not necessarily just about the upon seeing like a helper and hinderer, which one do they prefer? And maybe it could be that now they expect more social interaction from the helper or whatever it is, as you speculated. But if we've never shown them like a familiarization trial about a helper and hinderer, do they actually have expectations about this? And if they do, what is the nature of these expectations, which I covered a little bit in my chapter when I talked about moral obligations? So one possibility is, of course, when we see that infants expect fairness, for example, or expect that a person helps an in-group member, it could be that all of these, just like what Dion speculated, is there are learned through statistical learning, or they're seeing more examples of a person helping an in-group or whatever it is. And just to be clear, I don't think we have enough data to be able to say one way or another at this point, but I do have a line of work where we look at supererogatory action and whether infants do have a preference for supererogatory action versus
when you
not,
say supererogatory, whether... you mean like more than enough, superfluous action,
yeah,
going above and beyond, okay.
Right. And how might that actually help us answer this question? Mm-hmm. So in that line of work, we show infants a person who helps an in-group member and a person who helps an out-group member. And how we do it is that we use puppets, and we establish the group membership using puppet kinds, which is pretty commonly used in infant research. So we have, what was it, like a frog and an owl, for example, and then another owl needs help. And then the frog helps, or infants saw both. The frog helps, the owl helps. So based on previous research, we know that infants expect a person to help an in-group member. So in this case, the owl would be expected to help the in-group member, but they don't necessarily have an expectation for an out-group member whether they should help this owl that needs help or not, right? So the frog could help. It's not that it's unexpected when the frog helps. It's just that infants don't necessarily think that they need to help. So they can help, they can ignore. But we show that there's the frog, there's the owl help, frog helper, owl helper, and both of them help the owl. And what we're finding is that infants actually have a preference for the frog helper as opposed to the owl helper. And how we're interpreting this finding is that if infants' expectation actually carry a sense of obligation, so if they think that if I expect you to be fair, I actually think that you're obliged to be fair. If I expect you to help your in-group, I actually think that you are obliged to help your in-group. And it's not necessarily just about statistical learning, then they should have a preference for a person, the frog helper who does not have the same kind of obligation, but still does it. So in a sense, like they are going above and beyond what is obligated of them. And this is of course just like one way we interpret that data. But what we're finding is that they do have a preference for the frog helper as opposed to the owl helper who helped the in-group member. And Dion, I'm trying to ignore you, but go ahead.
No, so yeah, all I was going to simply say is that, like, I'm really glad you brought that study up.
Yeah, I know that you sent me a question about that. And I have a question about that.
Yeah, go ahead. So let me outline. So the question for the audience is that, well, in that study, they're seeing just simply more instances of in-group members. In fact, when you look at, or at least as far as my reading of the chapter is concerned, they're seeing exactly. Yeah. Twice as many instances of in-group members. Mm-hmm. Now, for anybody who does infancy research and who's familiar with habituation and familiarization, you know, I want to acknowledge that the study used familiarization, so there's no habituation, but it's still possible that mm-hmm. they're habituating in some way to just the amount of experience with in-group members. And so this looking toward the out-group member may not have anything to do with supererogatory action, but just simply that they've just habituated to the number.
Now, Francisca, tell him about some control condition that you had to account
control
for.
Control conditions. Yeah, so we do have control conditions for this.
Okay.
And that's actually but that's fair because we didn't cover that in the chapter just because we had word limitations, but we do have control conditions. So we had conditions where the first owl that needed help in the primary condition, now she doesn't actually need help. And they still see the two extra personnel there. So they saw two owls and one frog still, but in this case, they don't have a preference for the frog. And then also when the helping action, air quote, helping action is actually superfluous. And the first owl didn't need help, but then the frog gave her an extra object. The other owl also gave her an extra object that she doesn't need. It's just a superfluous action. Infants also didn't show the same kind of preference. So it seems that with these control conditions, we ruled out at least those lower level explanations for our finding. But again, like this, we're not done with data collection. We still want to replicate our main finding. And so there are caveats, but at least in terms of what we currently have our data, it shows that. And we have some evidence that infants seem to expect that their infants' expectation about social moral issues seem to carry with it like a sense of obligation, and it's not necessarily just statistical learning, because we're thinking that if it's statistical learning and they think that, you know, they're seeing more instances of a person helping an in-group, less instances of a person helping an out-group, it could just be that you know, they might show like a familiarity preference, and the results would actually flip the other way, that they would prefer the owl helper as opposed to the frog helper. That's how we think about it. And of course, like there could, you know, I always say this with social research, especially morality research, there are so many other variables. Oh, but you don't account for this. You don't account for that. What about this? What about that? And you're right. It could be that, but at least we try to control for some stuff. And in one paper, like we're not going to be able to answer all the questions, but at least this is the data and this is how we interpret it. We could be very wrong, but hopefully not. And I think that's what's so exciting about about research.
Franziska, this is really fascinating. And I remember that in the chapter, you also touched upon broader questions about, the moral obligations and mm-hmm. what this has to do with how that interacts with group membership, like the things that you just described in the owl and frog study. And then you went a little broader and you talked about, things that the implications that this kind of research has for societal issues, things like dehumanizing mm-hmm. Some of the agents that seem to be not attributed moral status or seem to be members of other groups. So I wonder if those questions are the reasons why you wanted to study the questions that you study, right?
And
the reason why you wanted to write this chapter and perhaps be an academic studying this question.
Yeah. So the reason why I got interested in these issues is actually based on life experience. So I grew up in Indonesia, in Jakarta, when I was 9 or 10. There was, and this is an ongoing, I want to say that this is an ongoing social issue that it goes back decades. But when I was around 9 or 10, there was a big riot in the city where I live. And the people from my ethnic group, they were targeted. So a lot of people were murdered. There were the women were raped. Like a lot of the stores that are owned by people from my ethnic group, they were burned. So it was just like a big massive riot. The government doesn't really acknowledge this until now. But because of that, like that just got me into thinking about like human morality and how that's related to intergroup issues. And I think, and there, the process is of course long, but that's why I start to get really interested into morality and the research about morality. And that's when in a lot of my work, I actually look at, how intergroup cognition actually intersect with all these questions about punishment, about how people attribute moral character and so on and so forth. And then also about dehumanization, like why is it that we tend to dehumanize the outgroups? What cues do infants or children use to dehumanize others? So I don't study applied like how these moral issues are applied in the outer world there, like how it's specifically it's related to, for example, like race or gender or ethnicity or whatever it is. But I want to know at the very basic of it, the very core of these issues, like how do we think about it and how does it come to be? Like, what does it look like very early in development? I think that's how I got interested into these questions.
This is amazing. Did you have a chance? I mean, obviously this is a huge question and then there's a mm-hmm. massive literature, some of which you reviewed right in a chapter. I wonder if any researchers take the route of actually looking at infants' less virtuous behaviors, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because a lot of research is about how babies prefer, helpers or hinder or helpers, how babies are reject unfairness and things like that, right? Mm-hmm. They're basically looking for virtue in us. Is anybody looking for signs of less
virtue? The antisocial baby.
Yes, antisocial babies. Kind of yes and no. I guess not directly, but there is finding showing that, for example, like infants, well, not infants, but like older infants, toddlers, when they actually have to divide resources between themselves and others, they would actually keep more for themselves and give less to others. So they may not necessarily adhere to these principles themselves. And there are a lot of debates about why is there this distinction or discrepancy between what they expect versus how they actually behave. And there could be explanations for that, right? Like we all have our own self-interest at heart. We all have like our own ego. And even though like we know what to do exactly in a particular situation, we may not do it. And that's just how we are.
That goes back to like criticisms of Kohlberg and ideas of studying moral cognition and that we might be very advanced in moral cognition, but be very immoral in our behaviors. And I ask that every semester in my class. I demonstrate that to students by saying, okay, how many of you think that lying is wrong? And of course, like inevitably all of them raise their hands and I say, okay, how many of you have lied? And of course it's also almost everybody. So I don't think that that's inconsistent in itself. And we would probably expect babies to be the same way. They might prefer things that if they do have this moral sense, but be immoral themselves.
Right, right. That's why I'm curious if somebody's studying the sort of interaction between, so on one hand, right, we might have some sort of moral core, right? It's not impossible that some of that could be present from the beginning, but how does that interact with, I mean, some of it, some of the social group studies, I feel like do touch on the self-interest, right? Because if you are identifying with a social group, then you're protecting the interest of the group. But I wonder if there's any sort of interaction. I mean, I think some of those phenomena may be inadvertently built into some of the studies, how self-interest, you know, the distribution of stickers, which I recall from like Mad at Your Next Work, right? Children usually want them for themselves. And so I wonder how that sort of struggle is resolved, especially if there is any sign of that struggle being already present in infancy.
No, I think that's a really interesting question. And I feel like there are, of course, like individual differences. There are some of us with more self-control than others. I know I don't really have self-control. But these are very, very interesting questions. And I think that that's also related to, you know, when you're talking about unvirtuous behavior, again, like there are a lot of, well, not a lot, but I would say that when we're looking at instances where one or more principles are clashing against each other, I think we can see a little bit, we can have like a little bit of answer from those cases. So for example, like in Lynn Beyond's work, where she was looking at, well, what if you divide resources between in group and out group? Like, how do infants think about this? And I think as adults from, you know, from Western cultures, a lot of us would think that when you divide resources, like candies between in group and out group, be fair anyway, like that's a nice thing to do. But it doesn't seem like that's what infants are expecting, at least when the amount of resources are limited. So it seems that they expect that, you know, a giraffe dividing between a giraffe and an elephant should give two to the other giraffe and none to the elephant. But this expectation is different when there are more resources available. So I think that's interesting, right? Like, is that actually an unvirtuous expectation, or is that actually just like how we think about morality and at the very beginning, and then different cultures rank order these principles differently, in that Western cultures tend to rank fairness above in-group expectations, for example, or in-group loyalty expectation, for example, and then some other cultures may seem to think that like it's probably perfectly fine to keep more for your in-group member and be like act favorably towards your in-group member than an out-group member, especially when resources are scarce. And I think, you know, I like zombie movies. this might seem very different, but I like zombie movies because I think it kind of captures a lot of human, again, like air quote intuitions, whatever you want to call it. You know, like when resources are limited, do you share it with the other groups? If you have like your own group, right? And you found like a crate of food, are you going to share it at the end of the world when it's really hard to find food? Like if you see like a person wandering, like you don't know who this is, are you going to share it with that person, or are you going to keep it for your own group? Like what are you going to do in that situation, right?
I mean, I don't think that you need a zombie movie to see that in the real world at this point. Oh, yeah. I mean, look at COVID, look at, you know, all of the hoarding of resources, look at the way in which folks are, you know, look at Americans' beliefs about immigration. And like, that is exactly that, precisely. Right? It's that we are supposed to give to the people that have that perspective. We are Americans and these are our resources, and we're not sharing them with other people, or we shouldn't be. And I think that some of these situations, exactly what you describe, when we, when either resources are scarce, or we at least perceive them to be scarce, there's plenty of examples in the real world where we are very like in-group focused in those cases.
Yeah,
it makes sense.
Yeah, exactly. So I don't know, Lena, that was a very long-winded answer to your question about unvirtuous behavior, but I don't know if that could at least shed a teeny tiny glimmer of light.
No, that was great. And I mean, I actually love your mention of the zombie movies.
Yeah.
Like,
it is a very good example.
Good zombie movies. When they're done very well, I'm like, oh yeah, these are like all the intuitions that humans have about whatever it is.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, thank you so much. This is fascinating.
Yeah, this has been a fascinating conversation.
Thank you. Thank you. I really had fun.
I'm so glad that you accepted the invitation to come on the podcast, and I've learned a lot. And yeah, I hope you enjoyed yourself.
I think you've done the podcast proud by pushing back to Dion.
Yeah. Well, I still have a question though. So, this is not a theoretical question. This is just but we agree that Candy and I are right, right? Frantism, yeah. Like, you agree with Candy.
Yeah, I don't know. We kind of split here.
Air quote.
No, it was fun though. It was really fun.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Are we going to end with our traditional question, Dion? Is that where you were going? Can we go back to? I feel like we didn't ask this in some of our last couple of episodes.
Yeah, no, we'd be remiss. Go ahead. You do a great job.
So when we first started the podcast, we like to end it on a lighter note because, you know, sometimes we disagree and that's okay. You're still in our in group of developmental psychologists. So we like to ask people a lighthearted question about what do you think that you would be doing right now in terms of your career if you hadn't gone into this area that we're all so passionate about in psych?
Huh, interesting.
To put you on the spot yet again.
I've always wanted to become a doctor growing up. And the only reason I chose psychology is because my dog got hurt in high school and almost passed out when I saw the blood. So I thought, well, maybe not.
Maybe that's not the right route.
Yeah, that's not the right route. I was still considering dentistry because I thought when you're dealing with teeth, that's probably going to be slightly less blood and gore. But then, no, I met a professor, my first psychology professor. Like, he was very supportive. He was amazing. And that's how I ended up here. I could have made a ton of money as a dentist, but no, I'm here. But no, I'm very glad. It's been a lot of fun.
Yeah. Awesome. Any other last questions, Dion?
No last question. Okay. What about
for you? Oh gosh, I know. For you? What is the mechanism? That's going to be your last question.
I am a perseverator, if nothing else. Yes.
I have to say, Dion, I know someone who is both your mentor and my mentor who likes to ask this question.
Yep. Come on, I'm sticking to that tradition. So my PhD advisor, Dave Rackison, is like that. Dave Sobel, our shared advisor, my postdoc and your PhD advisor, they're just like that. That's like the constant question we get, but what is the mechanism? Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, I'm like a carbon copy of those folks.
No, but I'm, and I love it because I think for me, I think I tend to get, lazy and I just think that, oh, it's innate. But I think it's very good every now and then to get this pushback and ask, like, is there actually a mechanism behind this? Is this learned or is this present from the very beginning? So it's always been fun to talk about this.
It's the same for us too, though.
Yeah.
Like, to have those pushback moments of of course there are some things that are innate and thinking about what would, there's still a mechanistic explanation for something that is innate. And so trying to push and think through those possibilities, I think that's why this podcast is so great. I think it's why these conversations are so great and they end in us all thinking more deeply about what it is that we do. So definitely appreciate it and have loved hearing about your work and your perspectives.
Also, thank you so much for the invitation. You know, learning itself is an innate mechanism, right?
Exactly.
We're born with it. There's something that's innate. The ability to learn is innate. Yeah. So if there's anything we can agree on in the podcast, then it'd be that point.
Wow. That's the last time I heard. It's probably the only thing I will hear in Dion saying.
Yeah. No, you have to sometimes wonder if I'm the reincarnation of Watson or something. I actually think there's something going on in the brain though. So I didn't contribute anything to that.
Yeah. Well, it's been a wonderful episode. Thank you to our wonderful guest and to our amazing new co-host.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, I hope that the listeners enjoyed the one listener. We have one listener. I hope that you single listener enjoy this podcast episode and be sure to follow us on Twitter, the It's Innate Podcast. If you want to be interviewed, please email us or reach out to us on Twitter. or reach out to any of us, Candy, Lena, or myself, and we'll be happy to have you on the podcast. Otherwise, until next time, thanks.
See y'all.